Concerned about your kids these days, wondering about their safety, just how far would you go to keep them safe? The perfect time for episode 18 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your That'll Be the Day host, Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. I'm especially looking for more reviews on iTunes, and I'd love to know what you think. Today, my guest is blogger and film reviewer Drew of Drew's Movie Reviews, who has chosen the Pixar-Disney animated classic and somewhat ironic fish-out-of-water film, Finding Nemo, while I have chosen the John Ford-John Wayne classic western, The Searchers, both with adults who are looking for abducted children. To begin, Drew, why don't you tell us something about yourself?
Absolutely. I am a blogger, as you said. I've been blogging for just over 7 years. I kind of started a blog just because I do watch movies quite often, and I wanted to give myself an excuse or a purpose for having all my cinematic adventures, so it's kind of giving me a reason to keep going to the theater. Three of my favorite genres are comedies, action adventures, and heist films, and I'm also an avid comic book fan. I read Marvel all the time, so like a lot of the Marvel movies, I still watch a lot of the DC stuff as well. I just really get a kick out of watching all those and see how those stories get adapted from the pages on to the big screen.
Great. That's the reason why a lot of bloggers begin their blogs, to sort of keep a record and to give them an excuse to do more with their subject matter. To begin then, I will share some information about the first film. Finding Nemo was released in 2003. It was directed by Andrew Stanton and Lee Unkrich, and written by Stanton, Bob Peterson, and David Reynolds. And it stars the voices of Albert Brooks, Ellen DeGeneres, Alexander Gold, Willem Dafoe, Brad Garrett, Allison Janney, Stephen Root, Austin Pendleton, Jeffrey Rush, Andrew Stanton, who is also one of the writers, Elizabeth Perkins, Barry Humphries, Eric Banner, and of course, what Pixar film would be complete without John Ratzenberger. The basic premise of the film revolves around an overprotective father, a clownfish who can't tell a joke, whose son is abducted by a fish collector when the son is on a school field trip. In order to bring his son home, the father must travel to Australia to a dentist's office where his son is being kept in an aquarium. He is helped along the way by a regal blue tang, a fish with a short-term memory problem. So why did you choose this film?
When I was looking over your previous episodes, I had noticed that you hadn't done anything with an animated film before. And then I ended up choosing Finding Nemo because there's really several different ways that you could take this film when comparing it to something else. It's a road trip film, it's a buddy film, a quest or an adventure, as well as a family film. So I was really interested to see which one of those you would pick for making your own selection to go along with this.
A lot of people who I ask on the show sometimes say the same thing. They just want to see what film I'm going to come up with to go along with their selection.
Originally, I had chosen Your Name, but I understand they had some trouble actually being able to get a hold of a copy. But the reason why I originally chose that one was because I honestly think that Your Name is like a truly unique film and there's really nothing else like it. I really want to put you to the test on that one. Unfortunately, other things got in the way. I feel like this is a good runner-up.
Yes, Your Name was simply not available anywhere on any of my streaming services, so that was that.
It's one of my favorites, honestly. Like, it only came out several years ago, and it instantly became one of my favorite animated films. I would highly recommend it.
So when did you first see Finding Nemo?
I saw this way back in 2003 when it first came out in the theaters. It's been several years ago.
What did you think about it when you first saw it?
Back then, I really enjoyed it, but of course, I was still kind of a kid. So I think I really just enjoyed it for the adventure side of it. But even after watching it so many times over the last 15 or more years, I still have not gotten tired of it at all. And I still think it is a really good film.
It sounds like you think it still holds up.
Absolutely. I think this holds up because it can really be appreciated on several different levels. There's the family aspect, right, between Marlin and his son Nemo. There's the friendships between Marlin and Dory and Nemo and the tank gang. There's the adventure part that I talked about before. Also, just a funny film. There's so many jokes. I laugh. Even, again, after seeing it so many times, it always makes me laugh and smile and have a good time.
I first saw it the same time you did. I saw it when it came out, though I was quite a bit older than you. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. In many ways, I was quite amazed with it. It was somewhat formulaic, but at the same time, highly original. It did a very good job of taking familiar tropes and doing something very original, very exciting, very different with it. It had a lot of heart. It's very funny and very clever, very smart in the way the plot works out. So I do agree with you. It's certainly a very enjoyable film. It certainly has to be one of Pixar's best films.
absolutely. Even to this day, it's really hard for them to top Nemo in my eyes.
I think that in many ways, I've had that problem with Pixar. Once you reach a height or you start making really good films, then the films that come afterwards, it's hard for them to be as good. I love the Toy Story films. Toy Story 3 is just incredible. But I tend to watch some of the other Pixar films and I feel like it just isn't as good as things like Finding Nemo, Monsters Inc., and Toy Story 3.
I agree. I think it's one of the side effects of starting out at such a high. Those films that you just named, the first at least 8 films are all really, really good movies. And it's really hard to maintain that kind of consistency for so long. So it's just a matter of time before things started slipping up. And at some point, you know, some things have to become the bottom of the barrel. And I honestly don't think that Pixar has any really terrible films. There's like a clear line of the really great films and like the good to average films. So it's great that they haven't done anything terrible, but like you can only maintain such a high consistency for so long.
That's very true. It's very true for any artist. It's very true for certainly filmmakers and film directors. At some point, you just can't make a better film than the film you made before. Sometimes you find yourself repeating yourself, and it can take a while in order to really find something new. Is Cars Pixar, I believe?
Yes.
I've never been able to get through Cars.
Oh, really?
I start watching it, and I'm going, I can't watch this.
See, I really enjoy the first one. The second one is definitely actually at the bottom of Pixar's list for me. I feel like 3 kind of bounced back, but it's really not hard to bounce back from 2.
Well, it sounds like you're a very big fan of animated films.
Yes.
Do you have an idea of what it is about them that really excites you?
I feel like the in animated films, the world is much more open than a live action film. With a lot of those CGI abilities nowadays, it's getting more of a blurred line between what's real and what's animated. But there's just something about animation, especially like the old hand-drawn stuff. Someone took the time to draw those each frame. With computer animation, some took the time to move those around. There's a lot of time and effort that gets put into just making things look the way they are.
I certainly agree that one of the things that I do love about animated films is she could do almost anything you want. And the rules aren't exactly the same for non-animated film. Your imagination is the limit more than anything else. And you can have all sorts of odd and weird happenings. When I think of things like that as to how free animated films can be, I often think of a animated film from Warner Brothers called Duck Amuck, which is Daffy Duck trying to be in an animated film. And they keep sabotaging him, changing the backgrounds, changing the way he looks. Heckle and Jekyll had a similar one where Heckle and Jekyll suddenly realized we're in a cartoon. We can do anything we want. So they make buttons appear or they make a car appear and they get in the car. And you realize just how free and open animated films can be.
Right. That's so very meta of a cartoon. Love it when they do those sort of things. Even with, like I said, with the way the technology is, like a movie like Avengers Endgame, for example, which had a lot of CGI parts to it, something like that could not have happened outside of the last 10 to 15 years, I'd say. Maybe even the last 5 with how detailed that those are. But that could have existed any time in the history of animation.
One of the reasons why I think many of these films, why fantasy and superhero movies are now so much more popular than even when I was going to movies 70s and the 80s, when you had Superman and things like that, is you do have the CGI. And the CGI did come up through animation. You first see it in such films as The Great Mouse Detective from Disney. Some of the scenes were done with CGI. One of the things, of course, CGI does is allows you to have animation where it looks like the camera is moving and the camera can go 180 degrees around an object or even go close in and close out. And you couldn't do that until CGI came along. That revolutionized animation. And then, of course, it's going to leak over into fantasy films, into superhero films, Marvel films, other films like that. What are some of your favorite scenes?
It's hard to pick, honestly.
It is. This is a very consistently good movie in which there are so many good scenes.
Yeah,
so,
especially because it starts off so good. Some of the early scenes where Marlin is dropping Nemo off at school, and even all the way to the point where Nemo gets kidnapped by the dentist, that is just full of so many moments. When Nemo first meets those other group of kids, the seahorse and that squid, when they're introducing each other, the seahorse is like, I'm H2O intolerant. And then the one fish goes, I'm obnoxious. It's so funny. You guys made me ink. Yeah, that's a good one. Like when Marlin realized that when they're going to the drop-off, well, why don't you just fry them up now and serve them with chips? Little jokes like that were like, I touched the butt. I really like the fish-friendly sharks support group. Like that whole scene was just great with Bruce and the other sharks. Parody of an AA meeting of sorts.
Right.
And there's just all these other parodies too that are clearly there for the adults. And then anything with the tanking, really, once Nemo joins them. The entire group of voice actors is just so talented and just did a lot with their parts and had me laughing.
I do have to say, this is an amazing group of voice artists to have gathered together. Everyone knocks it out of the park. It's just one great voice after another.
Which is really a testament to the Pixar being able to attract that level of talent. And with this being a road trip film, so you jump from scene to scene. If you take that by itself, it's just a great scene. I don't think there's one scene in there where I'm like, oh, you really didn't need that in this film. Everything here like serves a purpose. It moves the story along. It moves the characters along. And it's just well written.
I certainly agree that the scenes in the tank at the dentist's office are a ton of fun. I love them when they're discussing what sort of procedure yes. the dentist is going to do. And what's going to happen, and they rate it at how well he does. At this point, I also liked a couple of the Hitchcock references. When the niece's picture is shown, and when she shows up, you hear the music from Psycho. Yeah. And then out on the pier, when all the birds are gathering around, it looks like The Birds, that movie as well. I kept wondering whether I might be missing some Hitchcock references.
There's one when Bruce, the smell of blood, and starts going after Marlon and Dory. Mm-hmm. When they close the door on him, and he bashes it in, and cracks open it, and he goes, "Here's Brucey."
The Shining. I loved any scene with Dory. Dory was my favorite in the movie. I thought Ellen DeGeneres really captured it.
She's so good. She did a really good job of getting the nuances of the, I don't know if you want to call it fears, the intricacies of having short-term memory loss and having to deal with that all the time.
As I understand it, and from what I read, Dory was actually first conceived as a man. But DeGeneres was cast when they saw her do a routine where she changes the subject 5 times very quickly. And that is one of the things that constitutes her comedy routine. She just constantly is changing the subject. And she's absolutely hysterical.
She's so quick. I watched her Netflix stand-up. I think it was the first time I ever watched one of her stand-up routines. The way she bounces from subject to subject, joke from joke, is bonkers.
Yes. I thought she was marvelous in it. She gave a wonderful performance. I wish that the Oscars would allow voiceover acting to be eligible, you know, for nominations. Yeah. It is against the rules.
Unfortunately, animated films kind of get shortchanged in those award shows. I've seen argument over the years for ways to expand some of those categories, especially with special effects being a big thing right now.
I'm also one who is big on Andy Serkis deserves a special Oscar, and I really wish they would just give him one.
If anything, he definitely needs the Lifetime Achievement Award for sure. I wouldn't be surprised if he does somewhere down the line. He's done so much for film, especially like what he did for Gollum and the new Planet of the Apes trilogies.
One of the things that strikes me about the movie is absolutely how gorgeous it is. It is an absolutely beautiful, beautiful film, especially in its underwater scenes.
Yeah, I was watching on the DVD one of the special features they had on it. So John Lasseter made anybody who was working on the animation get scuba certified. So they mm-hmm. had to go down, go be in the water, watch the fish, and understand how all of that looked and felt. He didn't think they could animate it properly if they didn't understand it themselves and saw it firsthand. And you can see it. It just looks amazing. Like even, again, like so many years later, I think it's one of the downsides of CGI is that if done improperly, it can really date a film.
Right.
But this, it doesn't. You could compare it to, say, something like Finding Dory, which came out a few years ago, and you can see the difference. But if you're not comparing them side by side, it's really hard to tell that this came out over 15 years ago.
It does seem, at least right now, timeless when it comes to the animation. And just as beautiful as some of Disney works in the 30s and 40s, it's quite as beautiful and as astounding as Fantasia. Asia.
So even outside of what happens in the ocean, even in the fish tank, they put in a lot of detail where people probably either missed or didn't expect. I'm very big with aquariums. I've had some sort of aquarium since I was like, I think 5 or something. And one of the things that I noticed this time that I guess I really didn't see in my past viewings, if you look in the tank along the gravel line, you'll see mm-hmm. some algae building up as well as in the corners. That's because it's really hard to clean out that even if you have like an algae eater in the tank. You just don't get all the way down at the edges. If you don't have a tank, you probably wouldn't pay attention to that. So the fact that they had something like that, like something as small, the algae where it needs to be, I think was incredible. The plastic plants that they have in there looked exactly like some of the plants that I had in my tanks. Like I've taken filters apart. When Nemo was inside the filter, all of that looked exactly like what I've seen, you know, in my hands. The attention to detail is just, again, one thing that makes Pixar such a great animation studio.
Well, it is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. I could just watch the fish swimming around alone for a long period of time. It certainly makes being under the sea quite a beautiful experience. At one point, Andrew Stanton said that Albert Brooks saved the movie. I'm not sure I'd be willing to go quite that far because there's so much talent and so much that has going for it. But Albert Brooks is pretty wonderful here. And one thing Stanton said is he just thought it was funny to have a comedian play the role of a character that can't tell a joke. And apparently one of the things Albert Brooks did was tell a lot of bad jokes in order to get ready for the role.
That's awesome. It always seems just in general, when you cast outside an actor or actress's normal area, you'd be surprised at what happens sometimes. One of my favorite stories about Hollywood is Leslie Nelson. Mm-hmm. He was a serious actor until Airplane. That's all I know him for. I haven't really gone back and watched some of his earlier works. To think of him as not a comedic actor, that doesn't even register to me.
They sometimes had trouble getting the more iconic actors to do the film, because it was this satire and this comedy. I haven't seen very many Leslie Nielsen films. He was not a major actor. He mainly did B films. What most people probably remember him for outside of these comedies is a very brief appearance in The Poseidon Adventure, where he plays the captain of the ship, but he gets killed off very quickly. But it can be very exciting to see an actor do something new and do something different. Albert Brooks certainly gave a marvelous performance here.
We're talking about how the story holds up. I think that this is really, again, a strength of Pixar. And why, like, films like Toy Story and Monsters, Inc. really lasted all these years. And Incredibles, too, is another one that's at the top of my Pixar list. Because they tell these stories that appeal across multiple levels. Their movies can be enjoyed by children and teens and adults, parents, non-parents. Like, everybody can find something in Finding Nemo to latch onto and really appreciate.
Certainly the main through line is something that many adults and many parents would meet immediately identify with. What do you do when your child goes missing? What happens when he's suddenly gone? It's one of the worst nightmares a parent can have. And though it is not exactly, I would say, a serious movie about the subject, it does find that emotion the adults in the audience face. I think all of their films try to find something that scare people or make them insecure, some difficulty that everybody has in life, that everybody can identify with, and they manage to create a very imaginative movie around that. One of the things I thought about the movie is I'm not sure I've seen a movie that has so much death or the threat of death in it. Death is everywhere, even when no one's dying. The mother dies at the very beginning. It's the old Disney with the Lion King and with Bambi, where you kill off a parent early on. What's more terrifying to kids than that? But even after that, you have the sharks who are trying not to kill anybody and who lose it when they smell blood. You think Dory is dead at one point. This whole undersea world has as much threat of death as the scenes outside of that world. And then once they get outside of it, there are the seagulls who want nothing more than to eat these fish, or the one pelican who almost eats a fish, but when finds out, oh, you're a friend of so-and-so, now I'm not going to eat you. And I'm going,
it's amazing how much they could include that level of danger in a kid's film, and it seems like it's okay.
I'm kind of impressed by the fact that there is all of this, and somehow it doesn't quite register. Disney was great at this. Disney knew when to kill off a character, even if it was a children's film, even if it's Old Yeller and they wait until the very end of the movie to kill the dog. They weren't afraid to take Dumbo and forcibly remove Dumbo from his mother. They went there. They just went there. And sometimes it caused kids nightmares and was very traumatic. This isn't quite as traumatic, but it is just filled with the death or the potential of death. But somehow it doesn't overwhelm it and it doesn't really get in the way.
I mean, part of it too might be the bright, pretty wrapping that it's around as well. That might be like a sleight of hand kind of distract from all the possibility of death that's in this movie.
Certainly there's a lot of sleight of hand here. It's not just that, but it's also that it's very funny. You can get away with a lot more of this stuff when something is really, really funny. And this is really, really funny. And the plot is very involving. One of the things I thought when I first saw it, when Nemo is abducted, I'm going, how can Marlin ever possibly find him? He has no idea where Nemo is being taken. He doesn't even know if Nemo is alive. So he's setting out on this journey without any information or any clue as to what to do. I, in some ways, thought maybe the movie was going to be a goner at that point, because I'm going, how can you come up with a plot to satisfy that? But then they do. They find a very clever way of getting Marlin on the right track and giving him a goal.
that's part of the adventure. Once you get a goal, you got to figure out how to get it. And as you said, Pixar was really good at making that clear and giving him a way to find his son with so very little information.
I also thought it was very well structured in the second part of it, because it kept cutting back and forth between Marlin and his son, and they each had their own particular goal. And if it had only been focused on one, I'm not sure the movie would have been quite as interesting. I think it also would have gotten old rather quickly as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, because both Nemo and Marlin are pretty central characters to the story. To have only followed Marlin's quest to try to find his son, or Nemo's trying to figure out his new environment in the tank and all that, I think you're right that only to have focused on one would have really detracted from what ended up being in the final product.
Well, with that, here's some more information about the film. It won Best Animated Feature at the Academy Awards, and it was nominated for three more: Best Original Screenplay, Best Original Score, and Best Sound Editing. It was the third highest grossing film of 2003. It was made for $94 million and made $871 million. It was the highest grossing animated film at the time, and it was the best-selling DVD until Toy Story 3 came out. One of the unusual things about it is it began production with a completed screenplay. Apparently, animated film, when they first start production, don't have the screenplay completed at the time. Barry Humphries, who plays the shark trying not to eat fish, is an Australian actor who is actually better known as his alter ego, Dame Edna Everidge. And if you've ever seen this character on stage, she is hysterical. It's a very, very funny show. In closing out, is there anything else you might want to discuss or anything else you might want to add?
Well, just a little bit of trivia, extra trivia, I guess, because you brought
trivia
up...
Trivia's great. Always love trivia. Can't get enough of that.
That shark, his name is Bruce, the big great white who you're just talking about. He was named after the shark dummy that was used for Jaws.
Oh, wow.
Who the crew had called Bruce.
That's a nice little addition there. With that, let's get to my selection, and that is The Searchers. And first, some information about the film. The Searchers was released in 1956. It was directed by John Ford and written by Frank S. Nugent, based on a book by Alan LeMay. It stars John Wayne, Jeffrey Hunter, Vera Miles, Ward Bond, Natalie Wood, Henry Brandon, Ken Curtis, Harry Carey Jr., and Patrick Wayne. The basic premise revolves around Ethan Edwards, an intensely racist, the only good engine is a dead engine, Civil War veteran. He has not seen his family in years, having fought for the Confederacy and in the Mexican Wars. But when he returns home, his niece is abducted by some Comanches, and he spends 7 years trying to find her, aided by his adoptive nephew, who is 1/8 Native American. Of course, there are some similarities between these two films. Both, of course, are about young children who are abducted, both being sought after by an adult. In the first one, in Finding Nemo, of course, it's the boy's father. In this one, it's the young girl's uncle. But beyond that, there are innumerable differences. When did you first see the film?
I just saw this a few days ago when I watched it in preparation for this podcast.
And what did you think of it?
I liked it. Kind of the old style westerns aren't exactly something that I go out and look for, but I'm not totally against them. I watched some of the older, the Clint Eastwood films. I like some of his westerns. So I'm not against them. It's just kind of not the thing that I go out and search for usually.
I first saw the film, I really couldn't say when. I probably saw it in college in the 70s, long after it came out. I sort of have mixed feelings about it. It is considered one of the not just greatest westerns ever made. It is also considered one of the greatest films ever made.
Really?
Yes. I am sort of an outlier when it comes to that. I don't hold it in as quite as high esteem as other people did. One area that we can start talking about that sort of relates to this is, for me, the strongest part of the movie is John Wayne and his character. I do think this is probably John Wayne's greatest performance. He is an incredibly racist, unpleasant, bigoted man. He fought for the Confederacy. He didn't fight for the Northerners. He fought in support of slavery. He's a thoroughly awful person who really thinks, as far as he is concerned, wipe out all the Indians. He doesn't think they're civilized. He doesn't think they can be civilized. He thinks that they only exist to kill white men. That was unusual. Being a bigot wasn't necessarily unusual, but being a bigot to this extreme was.
When I was watching it and some of the information was revealed about his character, it definitely took me by surprise. Having a Confederate soldier be the focus or main character of your movie is not something that I really remember of seeing before. How completely racist he was, I don't know if that really works in today's social environment.
I think the reason why it does work here is you're not supposed to like him. You are supposed to think this guy is a really terrible, terrible person. The only perhaps good thing about him is he's the one who knows how to get the job done. He's the one who can do it, even though his definition of getting the job done is not just killing the people that murdered his relatives, but quite possibly also killing his niece, because he no longer considers her white, but now considers her a Native American. And his intense dislike of his adopted nephew only because he's 1/8 a Native American. To some degree, one could say that John Ford knew this. John Ford accepted this character, and John Ford to some degree was trying to start making amends for his portrayal of Indians in the past, though he wasn't a particularly non-bigoted person. He actually had a lot of sympathy for the South, and a lot of his movies are on the side of the South. So he was actually somewhat bigoted and racist, not just toward Native Americans, but also toward Blacks and Hispanics. The problem I have here with the movie when it comes to racism is, even though it creates this horrible person that you're supposed to dislike because he is so racist, is that in many ways the movie as a whole is also somewhat racist. The main scene for me is the scenes where Jeffrey Hunter accidentally gets a wife, and John Ford and the writer just ruthlessly make fun of her and ruthlessly make fun of Indians and use them just as the butt of jokes. Don't really try to create real, full, three-dimensional characters out of them. So on one hand, John Ford has created this intensely bigoted person we're not supposed to like. On the other hand, he says, well, let's have some scenes where we make fun of Indians and look down on them, and we don't treat them as equal, and we don't really try to find out that much as to whether maybe they're also victims as well.
I agree with that scene was a little hard to watch. One thing that crossed my mind is I wonder if all the Native American actors in this film, how they felt about this film with it portraying them in such a less than favorable light.
I haven't looked it up, but I think they had the same reaction to films like this as Black audiences had to Gone with the Wind, Jezebel, and other films with Step and Fetch It, films that ruthlessly make fun of Blacks. It was more accepted at the time. It could have been a lot worse. I mean, Gone with the Wind is racist as it is. It does have a lot of redeeming qualities, but it's nowhere near as racist as Birth of a Nation. And because of the new code coming out after 1934, it would have been almost impossible to have a movie as racist as Birth of a Nation. It just wouldn't have been allowed. Still, this was the time when movies were still quite racist and bigoted. And there are scenes, as there are in this movie, where the white guys can kill 5 Indians with 1 bullet, but the Indians can't seem to hit the side of a barn, no matter how close they are.
Yeah, there's definitely a couple of shots that were taken. I don't know if he would have hit that from that far away with that amount of accuracy, but sure.
Right. And they're far more ruthless. And there were some ruthless Native Americans. Nobody's going to argue that there were a couple of tribes that other Native Americans also did not like or want to have anything to do with, because they could be pretty savage. Here, there's almost no redeeming qualities to any of the Native Americans. There's another movie that John Ford made called Fort Apache, which I think is much better when it comes to this sort of racism, and he's much more successful. That is a movie that's loosely inspired by General Custer and Custer's Last Stand in the Battle of Little Bighorn, where Henry Fonda, who this time did fight for the North, but he's assigned to this fort in the West, and he sees it as the end of his political career unless he can get out of there really quick. While John Wayne plays a character that's more or less made peace with the Native Americans and doesn't really have anything that much against them, as long as they don't cause any trouble and stay in their place. Now all of a sudden there's this almost psychotic army officer who comes in who says, I have to do something in order to be sent back east so I can get my political career going. So he basically forces the Native Americans into a situation where he can slaughter them. And then it backfires because the Native Americans slaughter him. That is a much better movie that explores these issues much better than this movie does. I'm never quite sure I've understood why this movie is considered so much better than Fort Apache. I think primarily it's really the character first of Ethan Edwards, played by John Wayne, that he is so intensely and unapologetically racist, and it was a character that we hadn't quite seen before. Plus the fact that the basic plot is now a very popular trope and is used all the time. Finding Nemo uses it.
Yeah.
One of the most successful movies in recent years is Taken, which is basically just a modern day version of The Searchers, but in France.
Yep, that's true. I didn't think about that comparison to Taken before. to go along with your point about Ethan just being so bigoted and so really set in his ways, that I think in a way for me that kind of took away from his character, because I didn't see much growth of Ethan as the movie went on. As you said, in those scenes where they could have taken the time to try to understand the Native Americans a little bit more, just kind of based on what Ethan's point of view was of them, you're supposed to hate him, I guess, but I didn't really see anything out of Ethan that I really like. A result of that, I think the ending actually felt really out of place, because for the entire film, especially once they find Debbie and he's like, oh, I'm gonna kill her, she's a Comanche now, is what he said. Once they hit that point, you know, once they leave her initially and he's like, yeah, I'm gonna kill her, and then he finds her after he's chasing her into that cave, and he hugs her, picks her up and walks away. That kind of came out of nowhere. There was nothing from his character, from the story, that made me think that he was gonna change. So I didn't really think that he was gonna kill her, because that would be really counterintuitive, I guess, but I didn't really see anything from Ethan to make me think that he was switched from so adamantly wanting to kill her to, okay, let's go home now.
I certainly agree with that. And one of the odd things is that is one scene that many people use as a reason why the movie is so great, that he does change. But I also agree, it does seem to come out of nowhere. It almost seems like an ending that is forced on the movie from a box office perspective, though I doubt it. I'm sure that John Ford and the writer, Frank Nugent, and perhaps the original book, they had the same ending. Does seem a bit forced. It does seem like it's there to sort of redeem everything that went before, and I'm not so sure.
It's like one of those things where, like, one good deed does not really erase everything you've done.
They do other little things. They do have off-screen, most of the violence does happen off-screen, when the American soldiers have attacked a Native American village and just killed everybody, including the women. We don't get any information of that. We don't know why they did it. We don't know what happened. In many ways, it's almost thrown away. Jeffrey Hunter says, why did they have to do this? We also find out that one of the reasons why Scar is doing what he's doing is because his parents were murdered by white people, but I'm not sure it's quite enough to offset the movie as a whole and its attitude toward Native Americans myself.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
I also sort of have issues with the structure. I don't think the 7 years quite works that well for me personally. I thought that got in the way of a good flow. And in fact, in order to do that, what they do is they have this letter that Vera Miles reads in order to fill in all this information that we have in order for it to last 7 years. And I'm not a big fan of Jeffrey Hunter. So
I didn't even realize it was 7. I thought it was 5. But maybe one of them was just like a 5-year gap. Which I guess, to a point, that really doesn't really do a good job of then explaining the timeline. Because if we only see chunks as the story goes on over those 7 years, for a 2-hour movie to try to cover 7 years, there's going to be a lot that gets missed.
Right. Well, I think you are right in that they're reading the letter. They're probably just going over 5 years. But before that, 3 years, I think, had passed. Okay. It is based on some real incidents. The one big incident is they actually looked for them a lot longer. But also happened in abduction where a long period has lasted when they find the women. The women don't want to leave. This is their life. They have husbands. They have children, maybe. This is how they've lived. Ethan certainly is right in a certain way. She's no longer white. She's now Comanche. She's now Native American. But that's not automatically a bad thing. She's married to Scar. She has a place there. In real life, many of these people didn't necessarily want to leave. Many people consider it to be a very beautiful movie as well. It certainly uses Monument Valley very well. It has beautiful vistas. It certainly looks great. How did you find the look of the film?
I definitely think it was a very well-shot film. One of my personal favorite in film, I like those wide shots. I really think that they made a good use of that. The backdrop of the desert, I think, was well used. I really gave a good scale to the area and what was going on with the characters.
Though sometimes you could tell when it was actually done on the back lot and when it was actually done outside. But these were some of the favorite locations. You can see these in Stagecoach and other John Ford westerns. Is the inspiration for where the final scene takes place in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That mesa or that butte you'll find in a lot of John Ford westerns.
I didn't know that.
You'll also see the Bat Cave at one point. I believe it's the Bat Cave. There is a scene that they do film at Griffith Park. It's a cave there. It's a cave that's used in many, many, many films. It was used, I think, in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And I do believe it was also where the car comes out of the Bat Cave in the television series.
I was about to ask which one it was from, if it was from one of the movies, like the 89 Burton film or something else.
It would have been from the television series, and they did make a movie out of that television series with Adam West. I think Robot Monster, one of the worst movies ever made, also.
I think it's cool when you start picking up on those favorite Hollywood spots, like a cave. I know that there's some area in Hawaii that's very popular for like jungle canopy shots. I'll see that often. I'll be like, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that's that same spot.
Right. One of my favorite indoor ones, of course, is the Bradbury Building, which perhaps is most famous for Blade Runner, but is used in a ton of movies. One of the most recent ones was The Artist, where it appears as the studio. Do you have any favorite scenes from the movie?
I really liked Laurie and Charlie's wedding, probably because I found it one of the more comical areas of the film. And I just thought that was funny, with Charlie not being the brightest person, and then him getting to the fight with Martin.
And Vera Miles starting to smile about the whole thing.
Yeah.
I like Jeffrey Hunter's lines as, you're not going to marry him, are you?
Yeah, especially the way that he said him. Like, he strongly emphasized him.
Yes.
Another good one, it's a little bit different, but when Ethan and Scar were kind of having that negotiation inside the teepee, that was just a very intense scene. I will say that was some good acting from both of their parts. Make that as intense as it is. I don't think there's any music in the background either. It was just them talking pretty much.
It's a very interesting scene because they both know what each other wants. And we know that this is now going to finally come to a head.
It's kind of what the film at that point has been building to, the meeting between those two characters. So I will say that's one thing that I do think that this film did build too well, was that meeting between them, the two characters having a clash of heads, I guess.
One of my favorite scenes also is at the wedding, and it's the dance scene that starts off the wedding. One thing that John Ford was very good at was taking these folk scenes. There's a dance scene in My Darling Clementine where they're beginning to build a church. There's a dance scene in Fort Apache where they're celebrating George Washington's birthday. He seemed to have a knack for filming these scenes, filling them with a lot of emotion. He was just very expert at this. I also like the scene of, I believe the name is Fetterman, where the conflict with that character where he told him where they could find Debbie and where they could find Scar, and then tries to shoot them in the back.
Yeah.
How did you feel about the ending with Ethan walking off into the, can't say sunset, it's not sunset yet, but he walks away and doesn't come inside the house?
That fit his character. Throughout the entire film, he didn't really want to do anything with them. He did care about his brother. You could see that in those early scenes. Like the way they set up his character, he was very cold. So to kind of have him just drop her off, okay, I'm done, and just walk away seemed very in character for Ethan.
It is also one of the more familiar tropes of Western films. Characters like Ethan are necessary, certainly from a white man's perspective. This area it's uncivilized. Civilization hasn't really reached it yet. What's legal, what's illegal, what's moral, what's immoral is iffy at this time. It's a very dangerous location. Anyways, this is often a trope that's more used with trying to overcome outlaws in a town or something of that nature. It takes a character like Ethan to resolve the problem. But he's as uncivilized as the country is. So once he brings civilization, well, he's no longer needed and he's out of place. He doesn't have a place there because he represents everything that these characters are trying to get rid of. They're trying to tame the West and he can't be tamed. They have to go or they have to intensely change. And you're right. There's no way he was ever going to be able to change in order to be able to find a place within that family.
The other comment I was going to say is that it's a very Western ending. So you said it much more eloquently than what I would have.
Well, thank you. With that, here's some more information about the film. It cost $3.7 million to make. It did have rentals of $4.8 million the first year. But when it comes to overall success of a film like that, that's a little hard to really keep track of over the years. Those kind of records haven't survived as well. Warner Brothers originally wanted Fess Parker, who was playing Davy Crockett on TV, for the Jeffrey Hunter role. But Disney said no. In fact, Disney didn't even tell him that he was being offered the role, and Fess Parker said it was his biggest career regret. Patrick Wayne, who is John Wayne's second son, is in the film. He's the very nervous army officer who comes in during the wedding to try to recruit people to go after Scar and who joins them. He made a few films with his father and then made some films of his own.
I was going to ask when you were naming the cast off in the beginning if they were related in some way.
Yes, his name is actually Patrick Morrison because John Wayne's real name is Marion Michael Morrison. But like his father, he took the name Wayne. Some people might recognize Ken Curtis, who plays the groom-to-be, as the actor who more or less took over Dennis Weaver's part in Gunsmoke. Henry Brandon, who played Scar, was actually German-American, but you rarely use Native Americans for major roles like this. It is a movie that had one of the very first behind-the-scene films made as a way of promoting the film. And it is considered one of the greatest films ever made. I mean, especially other filmmakers and major critics really think this film is great. Sight and Sound and Cahiers du Cinéma, which are the two lists of films you go to if you want to know what the greatest films ever made are, rank it very highly. Sight and Sound now has it as number 7 on its list, and Cahiers du Cinéma has it as number 10, and it's rated very highly by such filmmakers as Jean-Luc Godard.
I mean, I guess everybody has their own tastes. I wouldn't place it that high.
I talk to other people as well, and people do love it. So I realize that I am vastly outnumbered. I do have to say, yes, it is one of the greatest movies ever made. Just because it doesn't necessarily work for me or appeal to me or I rate it that highly, it still, yes, by definition, is one of the greatest films ever made. In closing out, is there anything else you might want to add about this movie or both movies together?
Definitely think this was a good choice that you made to compare to Finding Nemo, just for having some strong fatherly figure try to find the kidnapped kid. I think it is good to show that it's not just the parents, too, who care about these kids. Even though we talked about Ethan and how he is as a person, but he clearly had love for his niece who has spent so much time to try to find her.
This is basically the same story. And I always find it interesting that you can do such incredibly different things with the same basic ideas. With that, let's start closing out. So I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
So I might have cheated a little bit and I chose 3. The first one is Finding Dory. It's a direct sequel to Finding Nemo. It's very similar, except this time it's Dory the one who gets lost, and then Marlin and Nemo are the ones who go set out to find her. My second pick is a movie called Onward. It's the most recent Pixar movie. It was released back in March, just before the pandemic hit. It was like one of the last ones to actually hit the theaters before everything shut down. It's about the brothers Ian and Barley. They lost their father really young. Ian doesn't even remember him because he was just a newborn when his father passed. It takes place in this magical world of elves and centaurs and dragons and all that stuff. The two brothers go on a quest to find a magical gem to use in a spell in order to bring their father back for just 24 hours. It's another one of those quest movies and family movies that's very in line with Finding Nemo. And then my last one is called An American Tale. It came out, I think, in 1986. It was directed by Don Bluth, which was an animator who famously left Walt Disney back in the 80s. It's about a Russian mouse named Fievel. Him and his parents emigrate to the U.S. Along the way, there's a thunderstorm that separates Fievel from his parents. And so he sets off on a journey to find his parents.
Excellent choices. I also actually have chosen 3. My first choice is a French comedy called Les Confrères. It stars Gérard Depardieu and is directed by Francis Leben. And in it, a woman's son runs away. A teenager. To help find him, she calls upon 2 men from her past, and she tells each of them that they are actually the father of the boy. The boy actually doesn't know who his father is, and the mother has never told him, but it's probably one of these 2 men. But in order to get them to join forces to find the son, she tells each of them that each one is definitely the father of the boy. It's a very funny and a very enjoyable film. The next one actually reverses the basic storyline. In German director Wim Wenders' Alice in the Cities, a German journalist meets a woman and her 9-year-old daughter. The woman asks him to look after the daughter for a moment, but she never returns. So the man crosses Europe with the girl in order to get her to her grandmother. Instead of trying to find a child, a person has the child and is trying to get him to a parental figure. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, Taken, directed by Pierre Morel and starring Liam Neeson, which is basically a modern-day version of The Searchers. What is next? What should we be looking for from you?
So as I said, I just celebrated my 7th blogging anniversary a few weeks ago, actually. So really just expect more movie reviews. I try to do some more long-form posts, but I unfortunately am not finding the time to get around to those like I want to. I have a couple ideas, but if they ever actually make it to the blog is another question. Every year I do a blogathon, which we call the Ultimate Decades, which I do with my co-host named Kim, who runs another blog called Tranquil Dreams. But basically, the idea behind the blogathon is we look at our favorite movies or like the participants' favorite movies from a particular decade. We're probably going to change it up this year. We're looking at maybe changing up the format a little bit because we've already done the 70s up through the 2010s. So we're going to see if we can maybe change the format a little bit, but still keep like the decades, the theme.
And the name of your blog is Drew's Movie Reviews,
yes.
Correct?
Yep.
Great. As for me, I'll run through my usual litany. I am a screenwriter and script consultant, so I have a Facebook consultation page called Howard Kastner Screenplay Consultation. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about issues concerning screenwriting and movies. I have two books of short stories published on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, horror, and fantasy short stories. The second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, is also available on Amazon. And I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find that on Instagram. The previous podcast was with Tob Liebenau of the Forgotten Film and Walt Sidney podcast on the films The Karate Kid and Let the Right One In, both films about young people being bullied. The next podcast will be with writer-director Steve Weiss, where we will discuss the movies Jaws and White Hunter Black Heart, which are two films about people hunting down a dangerous beast. So with that, Drew, once more, I would like to thank you very much for being a guest on my show.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me on. It was a real pleasure.